An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good afternoon. It's wonderful that Sami is here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Did those lemon tarts come from you?
From the tree.
They're mighty good. Thank you. Well, this is our last talk. It's our last day, really. Tomorrow is a couple of sits and a service, and then a couple more sits, and we're out of here. But we're not done yet, even though it begins to feel more and more like it. We're not finished. So at this point, I always encourage us, including myself, not to fall into a lot of talk. But keep the silence as much as you can and let it continue to inform you so that when the time comes, we have a choice, of course, whether to burst into lots and lots of talk and sort of have a party, or go more gently and slip into the world as your own part of the world, not as fitting into what's already there, if you know what I mean. You bring your practice into the world. Or you just put on the hat and the boots and you go back and it's the same as always. In which case, there really is hardly any point in this painful exercise because it's not easy. So it takes real attention to your intention in doing this practice in the first place and taking it wherever you go. I want to remind everyone, since we're working so hard, that often when we're sitting zazen and have been sitting for a long time, it's like pushing against a big front door and pushing and suddenly discovering that, oh, it opens the other way. This is a distinct possibility. So, in the Diamond Sutra, one of the things that Subhuti reflects back to Buddha is, what is the Buddha Dharma? It's what is not Buddha Dharma. What is called Buddha Dharma is not Buddha Dharma. Which means wherever we go, it's not just here, it's wherever we go. We don't have to call it something. We don't have to represent something. It's not something special. As as we sit, we begin to recognize that our mind is the source of our suffering and our happiness. That we actually have a choice in how we experience what we experience. We can fall down and crack our head and blame it on the universe and blame it on our parents and blame it on all kinds of things and feel just terrible about it. But the event itself is completely neutral and impersonal. It has nothing to do with us. It's just the way things are right now. So if we're really mindful and careful, we can bring that mind to whatever we do. It's not something special. It's just allowing what's happening to be what it is without imposing some kind of intense value judgment on it. Oh, this is a good thing and this makes me really happy. Oh, this is a terrible thing. I hate it. But this isn't enough, really. We need to really study the mind itself. And I don't mean going to the library and getting out another Buddhist book about the mind, or tuning into Upaya's wonderful podcasts that you can download that are from all the famous neurologists who are studying Zazen, though I recommend it to everyone. It's fascinating and opens up many avenues for us in understanding our practice. But that isn't really understanding the mind. The only way to truly understand the mind is to be completely, deeply with studying it as it lives us, bees us. We're we're Soto Zen people. And I often talk about this, that in Zen we pull up our bootstraps and bring ourselves into the Zendo and announce that I'm going to sit. I'm going to sit. I'm going to study the mind. I'm going to practice. And even though we try to be very modest and humble about it, it's a very assertive kind of practice that brings us here. It takes a lot of assertion because it's scary. And it's not easy. We know it's not easy. We know it's going to hurt. And so we come with this intention that has a lot of ourself in it. There's another school that's very close to Soto Zen called Pure Land, also Buddhism, in which the attitude is completely different. In which a practicer of Pure Land realizes from the beginning that he is hopeless and can do nothing by themselves. And so that practice is to put oneself at the mercy of Amida Buddha. simply surrender to Amida Buddha, with the understanding that if even once one could pronounce the name Amida with total authenticity, with deep truth, that that itself is saving all sentient beings, including oneself. In our practice, as we sit and the days go by, a lot of that I stuff begins to fall away because it becomes obvious that I have very little control over what's going on. The thoughts come whether they want them or not. The things happen whether I want them to happen or not. And so little by little, one begins to feel that I myself have not the same kind of control that I used to think I had. That I cannot control life. I can't control the beating of my heart or my breath. I can't control my neighbors sniffling and coughing. I can't control the blue jays. Though someone asked me once, he said the blue jays were interrupting their zazen, would I please make them quiet? I can't do that, I'm sorry. We lose control as we sit, if we're lucky. We lose that sense of indomitability that we need in order to come here in the first place. Until there is a kind of humility and surrender in our practice, when we allow what's going to be just to be. On the other hand, my sense of Pure Land is that coming into practice already in surrender, that it must be empowering in some way. And if one is truly able to surrender to Amida Buddha, that that itself is a tremendous empowerment. So that in some way the two practices meet in the middle. And although we don't call this Zen practice devotional, there is a great devotional element in it. Almost a requirement for it to be authentic. We say over and over that wisdom all by itself doesn't amount to a hill of beans. That wisdom without compassion is useless. One of the very first American students to go to Japan went there with the idea that Zen was a samurai kind of practice, and that you expressed contempt, you burned the Buddha and snubbed him on the road and all those things. And he entered the first temple and met the first master, and the master took him up to the altar, which is what you do, and bowed and offered incense. And the young man turned to him and he said, "You're bowing. I thought you spat on the Buddha." And the master turned to him and he said, "Well, you can spit if you want to, but I'm going to bow." To bring the power of form into what we do is to bring our own best self into each thing that we do. Even the small things. What appears to be small for us is really our life. We're alive. We're all very highly developed thought things. We're really good at thinking, figuring everything out, evaluating everything, trying to make sense of everything. It's our genius as human beings and our tremendous good luck. It's really good fortune that we weren't born in the Sudan this time, that we can be here and do this practice. To take advantage of it is to recognize our mind as the mind of Buddha. We don't need to identify our mind. We don't need to practice our mind. But as we practice, we begin to realize that most of our mind and this great intellect that we have is really operating here and here, in the heart and the belly. As well as the bottom and the toes and the knees and the hands and the elbows. That the whole thing is the Buddha way. The whole life of us is the Buddha way. It's not some other special category somewhere else. This is it. But we can easily override it with our clever thought. We can be so smart that we can't see or hear it, that we cloud it over with our self-concerns. When we chant in the meal chant about the natural order of mind, I thought about that for a long, long time. What is the natural order of mind? And then I realized what a greed person I was. And that it's absolutely true that if you're driven by greed, that you're always clinging to yourself and trying to make something happen for yourself in order to feel better about yourself. It's not even complicated. It's pretty simple. But it's one of the great sources of suffering. we chant the Bodhisattva vows at the end of each talk. And that's a very good way of ending a session as well. Taking home with us the vow to kindness, compassion, helping, not bringing some hot shot practice with us that we're going to press on everybody, make everybody all better. As I said the other day, in the terms of the book I'm reading, it's a matter of healing ourselves, which brings the healing for others. The work we do on ourselves is for the sake of all. So Kogan had his own version of the Bodhisattva vows, which you probably all know. We say, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, which sounds like a very smart-aleck thing to say. You poor sods out there, I'm going to take care of you. Hui Neng said, I vow to save the sentient beings of my mind. So again, we come to the mind and how the mind accepts or does not accept what is before it, within it. What Kogan said is, sentient beings will save themselves. That's faith and trust in the other. That very difficult situation that we find ourselves in, where it's me and everybody else. How do we be like this? Kogan said, delusions are inexhaustible, they will end by themselves. Our deepest desire is for our delusions to be known to us. Whether we're Dharma students or not, everyone is trying to understand this and be it in the best way. Learn to use this mind of us, the whole of it, all of it together. Dharma gates are boundless. What did he do with that?
Thus there's learning and study.
Thus there's learning and study, yes. That's right. Thus there is learning and study.
It's what we do.
It is. Whether we're reading a book or whatever. And Buddha's way is no above. And what's the last part of that?
It is happening in every moment, is actualized in every
moment. It's actualized in every moment. So in this way, we can trust our life. We can't trust it's going to be the way we want it to be, because it won't be. We're very lucky if even a percentage of our life turns out to be the way we thought we wanted it to be. I can tell you that from my old age now. It's really amazing. Amazing to get old and look back and think, Jehoshaphat, how did this all happen? Not by me. And yet with our true sincerity, our sincerity of practice that we bring to our desire for the Dharma, our way-seeking mind, it's always feeling the way to the next right place to be, in which we're supported by everyone else. Every other is on our side. Sometimes it doesn't seem like it. But every other, as the Tibetans say, used to be our mother. That's problematic for those of us who had difficult mothers. But the Japanese women turn their parents, when they die, into Buddha protectors and put their pictures at the family altar. And they say they may have been difficult when they were alive, but now they're dead and now they can help me very much. Because they're Buddhas. And they feel, they go to the altar when something is really difficult that's happening, and they pray to them and or speak to them and ask them what they think, and they assure the interviewer that of course they're not magical and they don't really believe that they're there, but in some way it's very consoling, the feeling that there's some connection that's ongoing, which indeed there is. It's where we came from. Whoever and however it was, it's where we came from and what our life is because that life was. And so in that sense, we can find Buddha everywhere also. So maybe that's enough. Are there questions, comments? Ryan?
I'm very interested in what you were saying about Turad, and because a friend of mine, the Mata Roshi, used to talk about that, and he said that those old fellows, they all tended to go towards Turad for the end of their life. And I just wanted some independent verification. He told me a lot of things.
Well, that's what I hear too. That's what I know too.
That's very interesting. So that kind of suggests what we're doing here, transition.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is part of the transition.
I was just going to add to that that when I heard Tom Wright speak, he was talking about a story about Pachyama Roshi, who was obviously very much into just the practice of Zazen and the self, selfing the self and all this, but he said even in his old age that his students were surprised that his practice really became just reciting Namu Kanzeon, you know, over and over, and that he really had this like deep faith in that, so even even he was sort of moving that way.
Yes. Yeah, and it doesn't take deep old age for that to be necessary, really, because that's an inherent part of practice, even though it doesn't look like that sometimes, but it truly is. Otherwise, we wouldn't have an altar. This is our mandala, and this is our projection of the untalkaboutable. So that's the heart connection. Yeah. Thank you. Jane?
Well, I'm just thinking about the chanting of mantras, and if it wasn't part of Zen practice, then there wouldn't be a rule that said you can't do it in the Zendo. I mean, Zen monks carry malas. Mm-hmm. They recite mantras sometimes. And other times they come in the Zendo and they sit zazen.
And they sit zazen. Right? Yeah. There are many practices. But the tendency is to think of monks sitting in a Zendo, even more austere than this. When I went to Japan, they just couldn't believe that a gaijin was wanting to go and sit zazen. They just thought that was outlandish. That's for monks, not for ordinary people, much less Americans. But those are all ideas. Bye, Jeff.
I liked what you said, that, you know, once our practice evolves or develops or it comes to, gets to a certain point, that it is basically like just the same devotional approach as Pure Land. Uchiyama talks about in the opening hand of thought that, you know, when you sit down, you entrust everything to your posture, and you have faith in your posture. You have faith in that. You have faith in being the posture and opening the hand of thought, and that everything else is taken care of at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I feel like I, like, even in my, like, maybe I have faith and trust in my zazen practice, even when I'm not sitting, as far as, like you said, informing me on the rest of my life, like where I'm supposed to be, or wherever I am is where I'm supposed to be, or the unfolding of that. So that's been a big question for me, because a couple of years back, I felt like all of a sudden my zazen practice was this devotional practice, you know, and kind of there's a conflict there for me for a while, but it's nice to hear this, and like what Ryan was saying, that it kind of comes, you know, that zazen practitioners of a long time end up there at the Pure Land. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Craig?
When I came to Jikoji, I had two hips, two normal hips, and after a time here, I had to get one replaced, and then recently you had also a hip replaced, so I thought it was kind of nice that we both could grow together. Sees things, unexpected things that are not always encouraging, and I certainly agree with that. But it has been very, not just encouraging, but inspiring for me to see you, Peter, whenever you come, and see your dedication to your students, and you are you were the first woman, and to this point in time, also the only woman that I've ever seen teaching Sesshin. And I've been very grateful for your coming here. While I was here, or maybe before I came, actually, I read something from Suzuki Roshi. He said once something like, our practice is so that we are prepared for anything. And I like that very much, because at that time, and for some time after that, I had the idea of Zen practice was, well, I get enlightened and then I save the world. And it took me a very embarrassingly long time to realize what an ego statement that was. I saved the world. Very well intentioned, of course.
Of course.
So, I asked myself, well, Greg, what's the most difficult thing in your life for you to prepare for? And then, rather quickly, the answer came: death. And so, since then, I have been rather obsessively focusing on that kind of preparation. But in the meantime, here at Jikoji, I wrote a book, and you are part of the inspiration for that book. I have it right here. I'm going to give you a copy, because you are part of the inspiration of the book. It's about women.
I see.
The book is about women. I took all of my courage to write it. And, yes, it's, I don't know that it's very Buddhist. It has one of the Black Madonnas on the cover, and also I think my Catholic background comes peeking through here and there. And the title is Womanhood is Holy. And so I'm very happy to give you this book, but I'm not giving it to very many people. I've decided it's a little too radical.
More and more intrigued.
Yeah.
Really?
Well,
so
you
can steal this book. <He's walking.
laughs> No, in the whole Jikoji Sangha, you'll be the third person to get a copy.
Oh, truly honored.
No, I hope you keep it hidden.
I'll be taking bribes later.
Once again, I want to say that it's been an honor to know you, and I thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Thank you very much. You've been a stalwart here, holding the fort, sometimes when nobody else is doing it. So I certainly appreciate how you keep Jikoji alive and how fragile it is sometimes. It's wonderful work, and I really appreciate it. Thank you. Paula?
The part that you said at the very beginning about can't say it, about not it was so tricky that I don't think I could say it about
the Buddha Dharma.
Yeah, well, it was leaving the Sesshin, and yet we aren't going to change to be like the rest of the world,
yes,
or something?
Yes, you don't have to put on the hat and the boots of everybody else in order to fit in, that you be yourself and bring yourself not your practice, not this sort of practice, but just your total real self to where you go. That's what we end up with. It's like we're cooking a sauce. And it starts out kind of runny, and then you cook it down and stir it carefully and take care of it, and it becomes really thick and tasty and good for everyone. And to me, that's what happens as I watch us evolve through this practice in, 35 years or so. I've seen us do this. We get cooked down. We don't turn into somebody else. We don't get even any better. We just become more what we are, more authentically what we are. And that's a truly wonderful thing, because that's what the world is looking for, and it encourages others to do the same. You know, if you can do it, then maybe I can do it too.
Can I do it?
You're already doing it. In a way, we have no choice, except unless we start to put on something fancy. You know, we can fancy ourselves up with curlicues and who knows what, but we don't have to. It takes courage. It takes heart to do that, because we're bombarded with ideas that we should be better than we are and that we're not good enough, because our whole industrial economic system is based on our feeling of discomfort about ourselves. And it's insidious. It goes deep. So that if we aren't self-confident, if we don't have faith in ourselves, then if somebody says, well, if you just buy this shampoo, you'll be famous and happy and everything will be okay. And it's that way about many, many, many things. Like that old guy said, if you sit zazen, you'll have a Cadillac car and a lot of money, you know. So this is a very humble practice. We don't get much. Humble humility comes from the word for humus, of which we're totally surrounded here in the forest. It's the rotting leaves that smell so wonderful as we walk through the wet forest. You can smell it. And the leaves are slowly dissolving back into their natural chemistry. That's what our humbleness, our humility is. We don't have to show off. But it naturally conveys what we are and who we are is naturally conveyed. We don't have to work at it. We just have to trust it.
Open-heartedness and the vulnerability that goes with that, and how to handle, the inevitable.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's misunderstood sometimes as a kind of doormat, that the bodhisattva way is supposed to be, we just lie down and let anybody walk on us, or we throw our life into the puddle and everybody can go across. And in one sense, that's absolutely so. But in order for us to practice, we need to preserve our practice, which is the self of us. And so it's important to know what real kindness is. And sometimes it's not obviously open-hearted at all. It can be pretty strict. Mm-hmm. So it takes a vast discrimination to know how to let what's in you that's truly loving kindness rise and address the situation that you're actually in, rather than some ideal of everything is pink and rosy, you know? Things aren't usually pink and rosy very much.
No.
So it's hard to be open-hearted and still clear. I think Zach was first.
Well, I don't want to get too off topic, but may I ask a question about Buddha's entering into parinirvana?
Yes, and this is the parinirvana sesshin. Yes. Come to think of it,
mention it.
Yeah.
Well, I just always like to ask questions related to nirvana or parinirvana. So, what is, I guess, your take on that? I mean, is there this final abode, parinirvana, that Buddha entered into, or that one enters into, or what is that?
When people ask Buddha about that before he died, he said, you've got other work to do. Don't worry about stuff like that. He said, your life is like someone has sent a poison arrow into you, and you're lying there asking what kind of wood is the arrow made out of. You don't need to go into that stuff. Just take care of your life. You had something, Jane?
Oh, I was just thinking, you know, open-heartedness. Open is spacious. Mm-hmm. And it just means, for me, big enough to hold it all. Saving doesn't necessarily mean rescuing.
No.
We save our pennies. We hold on to them.
Right.
We keep them safe.
Yep. Yeah, it's different for each situation. That's why we stay awake, because we have to know what the situation is. Otherwise, we're just on automatic. Plop, 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 plop.
And it's a very small vessel if we have a plan.
Yeah. Cliff?
One question. Jikoji normally posts talks on his website, and will do so in a day or two after the session ends, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Good. And also, we have copies in the office, so if anyone with a personal computer or a USB connector, like a thumb drive, could have a copy of all the talks, maybe around 6:30, 7 o'clock this evening, or tomorrow morning, if you want to get the concluding remarks also. So if that's okay with you also, I'll make that available to anyone who wants it.
Well, that's very generous. Thank you.
It's nothing. Thank you.
Electronics.
Wonderful.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.